You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode is brought to you by HP Instant Ink. No one is reading your mind, but HP Instant Ink knows when your printer is running low and sends new cartridges before you run out. So you never have to think about ink. For details, visit hp.com/instantinkspotify. Conditions apply. This episode is brought to you by PayPal. These days, choices are everywhere. Like, for instance, the milk in your coffee. Would you like it from a cow? A nut? A tree? Everyone wants options. And now your customers have a new option in the way they pay. With PayPal in person. Just generate your unique QR code in the PayPal app for them to scan. And start accepting PayPal in person today. Learn more at paypal.com/US/getQR code.
Hello and welcome to episode 132 of the Washed Up Emo Podcast. I am Tom Mullen from washedupemo.com. Today we welcome Anthony Green from Circus Survive, Seosin, and the Sound of Animals Fighting. My history with Anthony goes back to the early days of Circus Survive and working alongside him at Equal Vision Records for the Juturna and On Letting Go album releases. As the years passed, we stayed in touch and would see each other as you do when a band rolls through town. Anthony was always super into what I was doing with Washed Up Emo, and we'd check in when I'd post something about the Promise Ring or Brave. Anthony came on at an amazing time for punk rock and rode the wave as Circus Survive to heights not afforded many, and still could play anywhere in the world for solo material or with Circus Survive. In the hour we chatted, we got to catch up about his thoughts on emo, sneaking up on stage to ask Thursday, who we didn't know, about joining a certain band, how I forced Circus Survive to a Fused TV event for a girl that really just wanted Panic at the Disco, and where he is now, and what he has said to himself 10 years ago. His solo album, Would You Still Be in Love, is out now, and he's touring on the 10th anniversary of Avalon, his debut LP. If you'd like to support the podcast, go to patreon.com/washedupemo for the more you do, the more podcasting I can do. This is episode 132 of the Washed Up Emo Podcast with Anthony Green.
Siren Records in Doylestown was like the hub. It was where like everybody that worked there was super personable, and they would give you great recommendations on music that you liked. And there was there was people that were like into underground hip hop there. There were people that were into like death metal. It was really cool.
When did you know that music was like that was it?
I never really thought it was it. It was just it always felt like a good place to be.
Was
like,
it in the house growing up?
It was in the house a lot. It was in the car. I remember it in the car more than it being in the house. And it was it always was like this sort of like side dish to everything. You know, it was always around making things good. You know, there would be times where I remember, you know, listening to music, listening to James Taylor in the car with my dad, listening to my dad sing along to like Sweet Baby James, and feeling like vulnerability from him that I never got, you know, any other way from him, you know. And I feel like it always was it, you know. I just like didn't realize it for a long time.
And then punk rock, when did that enter?
My brother Mike, who got me into like Metallica and stuff like that.
How did he do that? Did he like get in
he
here?
Just had it. And he was my brother. He was in my house, and like I would go in and borrow his stuff, and I would go through his stuff.
Of course you did.
You know, like I would go through all of his shit, looking for like whatever, like firecrackers or like, you know, whatever. And I would borrow his records and listen to his records. I wanted to be like them. You know, my brothers all had like different types of music, and I remember, you know, listening to like Minor Threat and Fugazi because of him. And that was really the thing that blew my mind so much, because there was, I felt like I could do it. I felt like it wasn't something that, like, you listen to like Metallica as a young kid, and that just seems like this huge thing, like this castle that you could never climb. Yeah. And I remember hearing Minor Threat and being like, holy shit, I could totally, like, this feels close to me. You know what I mean? And it was angry, and it was, you know, it felt young. I remember the first show I went to was at the Trihampton YMCA, and it was because these kids that would hang out at this movie theater, like, in our town, like, we all would go to this movie theater and, like, either go see a movie or just walk around, and these kids that were, like, in bands were, like, you know, hanging out there, and they would be, like, walking to this community center where there would be, like, shows, and that's how I first, like, discovered it. And then I just got my parents to drop me off.
How old were you?
I was, like, 14, 15 years old.
Wow.
My parents, I had older brothers, there was like a decade or so gap between me and my closest brother, and so by the time my parents were a little bit older and a little bit more trusting when I was like, you know, and I would say, hey, I'm going to meet up with whomever and we're going to the YMCA and there's a concert there, and they're like, oh, okay, whatever, you know, my parents didn't care, they dropped me off and I'd figure it out. And there was a really healthy local scene in, you know, the suburbs of Philadelphia. You know, they're like the Starting Line, kind of like Kenny from the Starting Line I don't even want to say the name of the band because I don't want to like blow him out, but the name of his band was called Sly Winkle, and they were so good. And they were like pop punk, but they were great.
It was either a ska or a punk band. Sly Winkle is a ska band or a punk band.
It was the name of the band manager from California Dreamin'.
Oh, wow, what a reference. Everyone's looking on the internet right now for California Dreams.
But it was so it was so good. It wasn't just pop punk, it was like melodic. It was
cool.
And I remember seeing like Big Wig come through there all the time, and like lots of hardcore shows, mixed shows, you know, like Stretch Armstrong would play and This Day Forward would play, and then there would be like, you know, like an indie rock band opening, you know, like it was cool. It was really, it seemed healthy and contained and easy to like not be like a part of. I never felt like a part of it, but I felt like I could like, I felt like a fan, and I was like proud to be a fan of like stuff like that. I can remember just talking to people, like just walking over and being like, I like your jacket to somebody, and then being friends with them after that, you know, or like walking over and finding somebody that was like selling merch, or like at the table where they were like selling merch, at the table that where they were like making like selling their patches or whatever and shit like that, and just talking to people, you know. And it was like you knew you were going to see them at the next thing that they had going on in a month at St. Ephraim's, or at the Stalag or something. And for me, as a kid, it was hard for me to get to Philadelphia. My parents were like very strict in that way, where it was like they were a little bit conservative, and it was like I had to lie to go to the city all the time. And then it was like I was hanging out with Colin, or I was hanging out with their friends who could go out till 1 a.m, and I had to be home at like 11:30 or something, and it was like always a thing. My parents would be asleep, so it was like I knew I could come home whenever I wanted to, but they would be like, wake us up when you get home. And it was like this nightmare where it was like, all right. When my mom would wake up, like when you'd kind of be like, Rose, hey, mom. And she would gasp and leap out of bed and be like, you know, maybe she would notice what time it was, but I usually wouldn't wake them up and be like, I woke you up. What's wrong with you? You drank your fucking codeine tonight. Shouldn't say that.
More Frosted Flakes.
Yeah. I know, like, her cough medicine. Her bedtime cough medicine.
And then playing in bands?
My dad got me a guitar because I like pestered him about it. And one day on a vacation, this guy who like was like in a band that played at this bar that we were like staying above had a guitar that was just sitting there because they played every other night. And he was like, hey, you can take this up to the room and play with it. And I went up and played with it for like 3 days and was just like, this is so cool. Like, I didn't know what I was doing, but I was like just finding what sounded cool on a guitar by myself, you know. And it was like, I just remember wanting to do that and feeling like I could escape into something like that. I remember being a little kid and playing piano at like my uncle's house and just playing, making stuff up, and hearing like my drunk aunt be like, "This that was really pretty, whatever you were doing," and being like, "I like that. I like that you thought that was pretty. I like being able to make something pretty for you, you know." But fast forward back to where we were talking about, you know, being in high school, meeting kids that had bands, and seeing punk music like materialize in front of me, just with people that had like the you know whatever the instrument, you know, and like had the wherewithal to just make noise and had that confidence. I threw myself into it like a dance, where I was like, all right, I got a guitar, I got an amp. Who do I know that can start a band? Who do I know I could play with? I was like making stuff by myself. Where I would like play drums on a cardboard box, tape record it, play it through another tape recorder, and record through the original tape recorder me playing guitar along with that, and like making my own demos. Like I wanted to, it was like just a thing that I felt comfortable getting obsessed with, making my, I felt like I saw all these people like who felt like they had this sense of identity from it. And as a young person, I feel like you crave that. And it was easy for me.
And then singing. When did, was there like the, I think I can do this, or I can sing, or, I mean, you can't sing. I'm kidding.
it was like never a thing where like I could sing. It was like we had band practice one day and like nobody would do it.
That's always it.
And I was like, I'm down to do it. Like I'm down to do it. I don't feel stupid doing it.
Yeah.
I already felt so stupid just existing in the world. Like it was like throwing yourself into the dance. It was like, of course, like I'm already fucking, you know, I'm already
just
trying to
page.
Emulate Jimi Hendrix, you know what I mean? Like I'll sing, you know. I remember jamming with kids in like, you know, early like 7th, 8th grade that I was friends with on like trying to play Jimi Hendrix songs, and I couldn't play like, you know, like I couldn't play his parts on guitar, and I couldn't really even play the rhythm, so I was just
we could barely play Hey Joe in my high school band.
I was just kind of faking that, you know, like.
But the singing part, that was when you just said, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, and it was screaming. So it was like, originally it was just like, yeah, I'm just like kind of screaming and emoting. And, you know, every once in a while there'd be like kind of a melodic thing. But it didn't feel like I was like trying to like be, you know, technical or like singing like pretty. Just a thing that happened once in a while in a song. But like, oh, yeah, that's like a pretty part that makes all the dissonant parts stick out more. And it kind of evolved from there. I remember listening to Promise Ring, getting really into Promise Ring, like really into them, and Braid. And the melodies, like Bob Nana would write, that were just like so incredible.
They're all over the place too.
Yeah, they're very, there's like R&B shit happening in that. And early Braid was like very dissident too, and they had like yelling, screaming shit. And like being a part of, just watching that evolve and seeing like them go from like a heavier band, because like, you know, first thing I got into them was like a 7-inch that was Nothing Feels Good, and the other side, or I'm Afraid of Everything, and on the other side of it, I can't remember what the song was. It was kind of like a heavier song. There was some like it was a little heavy, you know, and I seeing them evolve into like a more melodic, more like rock, whatever indie you want to call it, like watching that and the recordings change, you know, being like, oh my god, this sounds like so much better than
oh
this,
yeah,
that, you know, and seeing that evolution was like, it gave me confidence. Like it gave me this weird confidence of being like, dude, I could totally, you know, as long as it, you have the right feeling of the song, it really doesn't matter, you know, that'll come through.
And the artwork too.
Yeah.
Was such like, I mean, Jason's stuff for them through the years has been like iconic.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, for me, it's super noticeable. Like I, when I'm flipping through like 7-inches, anytime I'm always looking for that stuff. Cause it was what caught my eye back then. I'm always looking for like the Lifetime, like Jade Tree, like that one 7-inch that was like somewhere in the swamps of Jersey that had like no sleeve. I'm always looking for that. It was like a split with Texas Is the Reason and Lifetime or something. Or no, it was something else. See, it's hard for me to remember all
this
stuff.
See, that's the problem with this podcast. The years go by, you just forget. It's okay.
Man, my brain scatters things.
It's
like
accepted.
That too. Yeah, thank you. I feel extremely accepted for my scatterbrainedness by like the people that are like support whatever we're doing, you know, like I'll tweet out something, you know, like fucking with the worst. I'll tweet out something with autocorrect and awful shit, and like people are just very forgiving. They're like, yeah, well, he's fucked up. Yeah. You know, like don't make him feel bad. Yeah. It's I don't know. It's kind of nice.
The I mean, were there other emo bands? I mean, it was funny. I was just looking at a photo of us from the Saves the Day show.
The one at the, oh my god, dude, that was so much fun that day.
But the funny part about this was at PNC Bank, the Big Shed. Yeah. You were with Seosin. Mm-hmm. But the funny part was you're backstage and Saves the Day wasn't playing every show. Mm-hmm. And they were playing that one, and I just remember you being like, who's going out there to see him? And everyone just kind of like eats their catering or whatever, and it was you, Chris Caraba, mm-hmm. and I, and you just like dart to the stage. But the funniest part was the girls just like clamoring to get a photo, and all you're doing is singing back Saves the Day lyrics that's happening live and telling them to watch the band. You're like, I'll do that later, you know, I'll walk you home, you know. It was really funny.
Some of my greatest memories are losing myself in the crowd and singing to like Saves the Day, and
I could just tell you,
even just
like,
in the car,
you almost turned off Anthony Green, the band, and it just went in, and I thought that was a cool.
I don't know if I can. I don't know if it's ever something that's turned off or turned on in that way, but there's times where like I'll engage in the dance of what Anthony Green type of thing is to the people who want that at the moment. You know, I identify myself as something like way more than that. Like, I understand that that's like my name and everything like that, but it feels like it becomes this thing where it also becomes this like expectation for people sometimes. And it's never about like being turned off or being turned on, but there's like a level of like compassion and understanding I have toward like engagement in it. And at a show and certain times where like people are like, oh my gosh, about something about the music, like I can engage in that in a completely compassionate way where I'm like, I'm not self-obsessed. Yeah. And there's other times where there's like, I don't want to engage in that. And I don't, and it's like hard for me mental health wise to engage in it. And I need to shut off from it. And it's usually when I'm totally shut off from it, you know, and I've pretty decent time balancing. But when you're trying to do that stuff, and you know, like that situation to me, I was never bummed out by that. It was just funny, you know. If you can't like just laugh at fucking shit like that, then it's like, what can,
and maybe
what
one
can
of them do? Got into Saves the Day
exactly because
they saw you being so stoked
or
on
they
it.
Were, you know, yeah, or it just, yeah. Yeah, or the moment just happened for everyone in a perfect way. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like the more you become obsessed with, the more I become obsessed with, like, how I'm feeling in a negative way, the more it's like, it just gets out of control. So it's like, if I start resenting her for wanting to take a picture with me, it's like, fuck that, that's stupid.
Yeah, you know, it was more of like a funny back and forth of like,
yeah,
watch the band, no, it's really cool. Like, it was more of bringing everyone
together.
Like, I was
actually
together.
Stoked that there was a picture of us going so ham. So I could show Chris later, because after that, I walked backstage and he was like, hey, I got to go say goodbye to my mom and dad. Do you want to come with me? And I was like, no, I don't want to go with you. And then later I went back and I saw him and he's like, it's so hot. And he's like in a sweatshirt and a hat and he's got these sunglasses on. And I had this little Ruckus scooter that like was just on the tour, and I grabbed it and I rolled up to him on it. And I just grabbed him and put him on it and just rolled him around the amphitheater for like 15 minutes talking about, like, catching up with him. I'm like, we can't talk back here. And got him on there and was like, how's life?
What did you guys talk about? Life?
I was just like, how is everything? How is it? You know, and he said everything was great and we caught up and, I think he said something to me that I couldn't remember at the time, but I was like, yo, that's the craziest thing I've heard from anybody in a long time. And I Googled it later and it was like a Kanye West lyric. He told me he was like on an ultra light beam and I was like, whoa, or something.
That's right
like
up your
that.
Alley.
And I was like, dude, you just blew my mind. I don't know what that is, but I'm like, I feel like I want to be there too. And then I Googled whatever he said and I was like, oh, I was like, ultra light beam. Like, that is the coolest shit. I can't remember exactly what it was. Again, my brain scrambles memories. That all might not have happened.
No, it did.
None of it. It could. Could have. It's scrambled eggs up there.
What about the you know, the word emo? What about the scene? Like, what? A lot of those bands, you know, that was the prime time. We're close in age. Mm-hmm. Like, those bands were coming up. Like, what about it did you like?
The coolest thing about emo to me, and the most appealing thing about it, was that it wasn't like it wasn't one thing. It wasn't like this macho hardcore thing, and it wasn't like this, like, you know, an unattainable thing. It was like a normal person. Like, it was like you didn't have to get dressed up, like, and have pins in your hair and piercings and tattoos.
Even hardcore, you had to.
That felt like you had to be. There was no fashion to it. It was like some people just dress. Like, I went to a private all boys Catholic high school, and my dress code was pretty much like like these pants, and like it's pretty much what I wear all the time, and like a button up shirt, and like I would just like take the button up. I didn't feel like I had to dress up to be into what I liked, and whether it was like Coalesce or whether it was like you know, the Promise Ring or like Piebald or something, it wasn't like a singular thing. It was about being yourself, it felt like. Mm-hmm. You know. And I really liked that. I really liked that there wasn't, in my mind, it wasn't like emo was this. It was like, it was everything. It was everything. It was like everything that emoted. You know, it was like, you heard a band like Cave-In, you know, who would like, they would be heavy as fuck and brutal, but then it would have this like beautiful part in the middle that was like, it was anthemic, you know. And I remember that breaking through to me and having it, this contrast of like this dissonance and consonance. And I loved that about it. You know, the fact that you could be like, you know, like, it was like pretty and brutal at the same time.
I was always, it could break at any moment.
Yeah.
That feeling.
Yeah. Like, I liked the idea that like you didn't, you know, I loved punk rock, but I didn't love the whole like elitists, you know, you had to dress the part idea of it. And I wasn't into fashion at all. My mom picked my clothes out for me. I was a husky kid, so I was like, I liked the fact that I could just be wearing like a t-shirt and like slacks and like my Chucks or Vans, and it was like, that was cool. You know, I didn't feel out of place. No one ever made you feel out of place at those shows. Like, I, as a kid that was I wasn't shy, you know, it was easy for me to like go and make friends at those places, because it was just filled with other people who wanted to be around music, wanted to be around other weirdos, art, you know.
And then, do you think, I mean, post Bleed American, you know, those years, especially into the mid 2000s, mm-hmm. what changed as you were in it as a band? I've asked a lot of bands this, that sort of, you had seen it before, like Kenny, when I talked about it with him, or I talked about it with Buddy from Senses Fail, like that before, and then this sort of apex moment where everyone's paying attention, and then the after. Did you feel anything while making music through those years that things were changing?
When Bleed American came out, I was like in bands and stuff, but not really. Like, I was at home, like I had music as this thing that I would love to do, but like I remember hearing Full Collapse and being like, this fucking band is going to be huge. Like, this, I want to hear this song over and over again. And I knew the band, I knew of them, and I saw them play with This Day Forward, and I'd seen them play a couple times and they were amazing, but it was like, this was something else. I remember hearing that. I remember hearing that first song off Bleed American, and not thinking like this band's going to be huge, but just feeling like so grateful that I had it, that I could listen to it in my car, that it was a part of my life, you know. So I wasn't concerned with the music scene in that way. Like, it was just, I was a part of it in that way, where I felt like I had understanding in a car crash. I listened to it over and over. I listened to the whole Full Collapse over and over. I remember buying it on CD and then having to drive to my friend's house to go make the tape, and like sitting there and making the tape, and then and going out of my way so I could listen to it, and then just listening to it over and over and over again. And same thing with like the first Coheed record. Like, just that was a part of my life. That I was, when I moved to join Seosin, that stuff was already happening. I didn't, when I got to California, I didn't know that screamo and emo and hardcore had blended into this thing out there.
What was that, like, oh, was that, oh, it was three? Like, oh, it three or four?
Oh, 04 or something. And you know, Coheed was already kind of, like, they were blowing up in, like, the our world in a way where it was like, whoa, and Thursday was already, like, on MTV and shit, and it was like... I moved to California just because, you know, I was like, this band wanted me to be in the band. I had no idea what I was doing. Like, I didn't want to be home anymore. I was, you know, going through all this weird stuff in my 20s, and I was like, I'm out of here. I can't fucking do this. I felt like I was under my parents' thumb, you know, and I needed to get out of there and feel like I was going to make my own thing and I could start over. And when I got out there, I just jumped into it. Like, it wasn't like I don't know how all those other guys feel about it, but I never felt like attached to it in a way where it was like mine or I was a part of it. I was just like a witnessing it. And then I got to like hop in at a time where it was like
taking off.
It was taking off. And you know, that was that.
When you were meeting bands, like, did you feel like you had known? It, you know, dude, it gets like when they wouldn't
hear a
know
funny
or they
story for yeah. this fucking shit. There's a funny story I didn't even think about. This is a funny story. This better be a funny story.
Speak into the mic.
So Meredith's uncle had a friend that was playing in the Mighty Mighty Bosstones. Had been in a band called Spring Hill Jack. A good dude, my kind of cousin through her, Ronnie Wagona, sings for that band. And was like a singer in that band and was like in the ska band scene back in the day. Still plays music now, is an awesome dude. And he had like a, they had a mutual friend. Meredith's aunt was Ronnie's brother, Ronnie's sister. And she got us into that Warp Tour with her uncle because they knew the trumpet player for the Bosstones. And they were like, hey, we're going to go to this Warp Tour. You should come see the Bosstones with us.
What year was that?
I fucking have no idea. But I had never gone to a Warp Tour before, ever. And
how old were you?
I was like probably 18 or 19 or something like that.
Okay.
I might have been like 19. I was like, I just didn't go to Warped Tour. I just, it was like never a thing I went to. I not for any other reason other than it's just like I just never did it. I'm not saying I like only went to local shows or whatever like that. I just feel like that's probably what it was. And
So I went
and Thursday was playing. And I hadn't seen them in years, and I hadn't seen them play in years, and they were already this massive band. They were playing to all these people, and I remember sneaking up on the side of the stage. I don't know how I got up there, but I was backstage and sneaking up and watching them play from the side of the stage and being like, this is fucking crazy. Watch sitting right behind Tucker. And after the show, I went up to Tucker and Tom, and I was like, hey, listen, I know you don't know me. You know my friends in This Day Forward. I got asked to join this band from these dudes that are in Open Hand, that were in Open Hand, that live in California, and I don't know what the deal is, and I, like, kind of, part of me wants to do it. I don't know. I know you guys toured with them, and you know them. What's the deal? Should I do it? And they were like, what? They were so nice to me, but they were like, yeah, they were really nice guys, and they were really nice guys, and they were, like, super nice to me, but
You could tell?
I could tell, because, especially now, you know, from just having conversations with people who are nervous, you know. And I remember looking at Tucker and being like, this is the handsomest. Tucker and Tom, I remember talking to both of them and being like, these are the handsomest dudes I've ever seen in my entire life. Like,
Tucker
ever.
Still looks great.
He is, dude.
Just saw him a couple weeks ago at Jimmy
like
World.
He's like a fine wine. He's like a fine
wine. I'm
going to
see him next Thursday.
He's beautiful.
They're opening up the Racket Club Get Up Kids show, yeah. His band.
Dude, his new band's awesome.
And beautiful, and he's beautiful.
He's such a handsome man, and I'm so lucky to be friends with.
So it was funny that you noticed there was some hesitation.
I wanted to talk to them, you know, and I that's probably what it was. They just got off stage too, so it was like this punishing kid, and I think I might have asked them later on if they remember. I would be remiss if they actually did, you know. But I have the memory of just like Tucker like kneeling down doing shit like breaking down and being like hi lady. And yeah, and I remember feeling like they were really cool about it. Like, I didn't feel like they were like they were not shitty to me at all. They 100% could have been.
Yeah.
But I was like nervous to talk to them.
I mean, they were definitely a band that when I was walking around, it was my first job in the industry. They were like, you know that Thursday band? Like, yeah. What other bands? And it just started being like, why are the A&R people bugging me?
Yeah.
Shouldn't they know what's going on? And then I slowly realized that it was like this feeding frenzy.
Yeah.
From a scene that I thought was sort of this.
What was it like for you as a person? Because you were actually in, I was just like this player. I was like a pawn, you know, just floating around, like just trying to sing for people. Like, I didn't feel attached. I didn't have the. It wasn't a part of me in that way. I was like more of a part of it, you know. It must have been weird for you to see this thing that you had like almost cultivated partly, and then to see it like kind of become something that was hard to control. Like, it must have been a difficult.
It just got weird when other people were talking about it and not referencing the full history, like just being like, emo started in 2007.
Yeah.
You know, that's what it was. Yeah. And I think that was the part. I mean, 2001, the A&R guy, actually just, I went through my Jimmy Eat World discography last night to make sure I had everything in iTunes and like metadata stuff. And I remembered I had the demo tape of Bleed American.
I saw that.
Yeah. But that, the A&R guy just goes, oh, you like this band, check this out. And I listened to it. I was like, there's 5 singles on this.
Yeah.
Holy crap!
Holy shit, dude. This I remember. You know the song. Are you listen, Sweetness?
Yeah,
I heard that they posted that on their website
way before
a year and a half, 2 years.
That was their set closer.
Yes. So they played a Clarity show in Philadelphia at the Unitarian Church. Unitarian Church is where they played their Clarity show. Okay, that was like how long ago it was. Like, it was like on Clarity, and I'm pretty sure that was slowly they came back.
Of course,
and they played that, and it was like, and then they put it on their website in this crazy different version, slightly faster. Lyrics were tweaked in one or two different ways.
I have both. If anyone wants it,
dude, you might have to send me that original version because I have never been able. It was like Napster days.
I was just listening to it yesterday. I'll send it to you.
I remember listening to that so over and over again, just becoming obsessed with it.
I mean, it was like one of the ones to make it out, and then not.
When you heard the record version, you're just like, oh my God, this is so fucking crazy.
And huge.
Yeah.
But to think that, like, that happened where the middle and all those things, and then I started getting all these calls and people being like, what shows are you going to?
Yeah.
And people wanting to know what band I was going to go check out. And then it got really weird.
Yeah.
Like, the president just pointing at bands on the CMJ chart and being like, is this one?
Yeah.
Is it? I'm like, what? But then it was this feeding frenzy.
Yeah.
But then
don't you imagine that's what happens culturally, like, with everything? Like, especially with this, like, whatever you want to call it, industry with music. Like, every few years, there's something like that.
I mean,
like
think of that same time in New York.
Yeah.
The Strokes.
Yeah,
Interpol.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
It's just what happens,
yeah,
so, and then every dude looks the same way.
Boom. It's what's going to happen in any market that's set up like that. That's why what's so endearing about a lot of this is that it also creates this kind of counterculture of people who are like, "Hey, we can make a sustainable living at this. Do it our way. Do it a way that serves us in a creative way." I spiritual way, and we can do it sustainably, and we can do it and not feel like we're trying to sell a fucking product, that we can be like a part of a community that takes care of itself. And that's what I feel like that is what's going on. That's what I feel like I've been trying to build around things that I do in the way of like, if this, you know, trying to be sustainable without doing anything you just don't really feel connected to.
Well, that was my next question about Circa, because I found that really interesting in that I remember, if you remember, I accidentally made the marketing sticker made it look like a hardcore record because I didn't know any other way to promote you guys.
That was my fault. Okay.
I remember Nick yelling at me for putting Taken so large on the sticker, and I go, what else am I supposed to do? But my reason of saying that is the marketing of it, you guys transitioned from that and stayed. And I think what happened with a lot of bands around you was that they went like this and tried to hit it instead of this, let me cultivate, let me have this first record and learn this, let me have the second record and learn this. And now you've got this sustainable thing. And I think that's what people forgot.
Tell you what, guy who really taught me a lot about that in early circa times, and we've had a relationship that's been going up and down over the years, and we don't really talk that much, but a guy named Brian Schechter, who managed My Chemical Romance, came into circa's career early on, and there was a lot of information coming at us at the time, and there was some things about the slow build and the control, and this dude could have done X, Y, and Z with the band and really, really liked the idea that we wanted to do it a specific way, and really made me feel confident in a way that nobody else that I'd worked with in any capacity at the time made me feel as an artist. Like, hey, if you have this intuition, you need to follow it. And if it means that you're going to make less money, so be it. Because that is what's going to make you happier in the long run. And that dude installed that in me. And I don't know whether he was a guru for me at the time. I don't know whether that was something he personally took in his life. And I don't know where it came from, but I always remember him being very adamant about that. There were things that came up with the band that we said no to that he was very okay with, because he was like, yo, you'll be fine. You just got to do what's right for your band.
You know what's really interesting about that? I remember being at the office, mm-hmm. and we'd be in a meeting with Dan and Greg and all these people. Yeah. Paul, we're all sitting here talking about you guys and your first record. And I remember Dan being like, hey, talk to Anthony or talk to Brian, talk to Colin, Brennan. It's they're no on this, no on this. And what those no's were things that all the bands were doing at the time. And I'm not saying you said no to everything, but I took that as this band listened.
Yeah.
They looked at everything and said yes or no. Instead of just saying yes, 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 yes. Make me a deep ring down to my navel. Make it neon. Like, it was like, no, I want this shirt. I want it this way. I want. And I think that was
it's
why.
So tough. It's really tough.
But early on to think that.
Well, you know, you say you bring up Equal Vision and like those guys like Dan, Greg, Glenn, you. That was something also that I just felt like I came in on. Like, you guys had this relationship with This Day Forward that was so already a thing. And I've always felt like so scared. Fucking weird.
Why?
And like, I don't know. Like, I just always felt like I was like, didn't like, I was like trying. I felt like I needed to do good by everyone there. And it was like, not them. Dan, you guys were the shit. You were awesome. But I also looked at you as like this cool kids that were just letting me be part of their club. And I was like, wanted to do good by you. And as like a hyperactive, like insecure fucking dummy. You know, that probably manifested itself in weird ways, you know, and I'm cool with that now. But man, I got so lucky with you. I got so lucky with Equal Vision. Like, and I was such a fan. You talk about Saves the Day. Like, I still have
this
sampler,
you
know, with like Strider on it. And, you know, what's funny is like you're talking about emo. Like, I have a different perspective on it, because when I did emo night in Las Vegas, and I don't know. The Brooklyn Bowl one, and it was a nightmare for me, because I went out and I had this playlist that it started with At the Drive-In, and I thought I was safe with that. I thought At the Drive-In was a safe thing, but I didn't know, dude, and I was getting tweeted at people, and luckily I had, you know, friends on my crew, and like, you know, my tour manager Jeff at the time was like, came out and like really helped me. Like, it was playing, you know, Jimmy Eat World and awesome shit, and like saved the day pretty much. But like, people were like, yo, you had to open with Fallout Boy. And you had to open with Panic at the Disco. And both of those bands are incredible, and I love them. But it was like, when I was thinking about it, I was like, shit, I almost opened with like fucking, with like Piebald. You know what I mean? Like, or like, I, you know, I was like completely off. Like, you know, I would have opened with Icarus Line. You know what I mean? Like, if it was up to me, you know, but it was, or Appleseed Cast or something
like that.
But
that's the thing. Do you think there's a certain fan base that was only into that for a few years and that's it?
I think it just grew. You know, it just grew like anything.
So there's a certain group of fans that will, that's just what happens at mass.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
But I totally get when you sat there and you were like,
they just identified to do something else. Like, for them, their Panic at the Disco and Fall Out Boy and My Chem, whatever, that was just my whatever, Lifetime or whatever, Metallica or whatever it was. It's that thing, and you have, as an artist and as just a human being, like, you want to be a part of a community, you have to look at the things like that as a, and welcome that.
But owning the word, or owning that that's only what it is hard.
You can't be attached to it. And like, so I was never attached to it, and I always saw it as this versatile thing. So when it changed into this, like, more of a mainstream, whatever you want to call it, thing, it was good for me. And, like, I couldn't deny it. It was, my bands were getting bigger because these bands that were, you know, saying or doing that, carrying that flagship, they were making it easier for me to get my weird music accepted by people. That music is heavily drenched in just emotive. Sometimes people want to call it depressing.
I mean, it's definitely a perfect storm.
Yeah,
to have Fuse and MTV2. Like, I got meetings with them.
Fuse still here?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's a channel, but I don't know if they still. Mm-hmm. But to literally a label upstate,
yeah,
calling MTV and saying, please listen to watch my video, they, yeah, took my meeting.
Yeah.
And Fuse was like, obviously had some supporters in there, but that took,
no,
like,
but that was cool.
Hey, here's this video, here's why. And but I talked to so many people. I'll just randomly mention, like, how'd you find out about X Band, how'd you find out about Circa, and they're like, Steven's on Title Rock Show.
Yeah.
You know, but that totally was like, you,
dude,
had the mouthpiece.
Title Rock Show was cool. Like, I never doing that thing when we played. I played.
Did I make you do that?
I played.
Oh no, the Fuel thing I made you do.
No, you made us do this thing when we went to this girl's house who won a thing, who didn't know who we were.
Yes,
who
loved, that was my fault.
Panic, and was like, was like wishing that it was Panic, and basically got the chair at the thing because of, like, Brandon Urie sitting on this, like, couch. She won this couch. She was like talking to me about, like, Brandon Urie was on this couch. I'm like, that's awesome. Like, yeah, he's handsomer than me. Anyways, so here's a song that you've never heard, you know, on your lawn.
You know, I have a bunch of those saved.
Week. Yeah, no, I.
If you'd like to see those,
that video is cool. And what's cool is I played Miracle Sun with Brendan.
Oh, right.
And I didn't know that wasn't going to be a Circa song yet.
Really?
We didn't know what Circa was yet, really. So it was like, I was, had all these songs written that I was like, hey guys, let's make it like this crazy thing. And it just didn't feel right, you know. But I remember thinking, like, that could be a new Circa song. I remember that. The band loving it. It just didn't, maybe I didn't fit it in right.
A couple of stories, and I have a few more questions. I remember accidentally calling your mom during the Juturna session.
God.
And like, I was like, Anthony, no, this is his mother. Oh, is Anthony there? No. And it was like, I don't know why, but I had her number,
yeah,
as your number.
Yeah.
That was maybe before phones. I don't know.
I for a long time, I had my mom's cell phone. I had my mom's cell phone for a really long time. Even when I joined Seosan, I didn't have one. You know, like, I didn't have, I think those guys had Sidekicks. I'm not going to throw them under the bus right now,
dude.
But they
Ames,
were Sidekick,
bro.
Guys.
Ames, bro.
Sorry, Bo. Sorry, Chris. I don't think Chris had a Sidekick, but I know that there were some Sidekicks getting flipped.
Also during Juturna, did you know the amount of edits I had to do for Act Appalled?
Wait, which one?
With all the girl.
The video? Oh,
the
my
video.
God, I remember that.
I remember,
dude, why was it so hard getting that video made? Like, it was crazy. Because nowadays, they play, like, straight up hardcore porn on MTV. And there was like, yo, we can't see a tablet going in. Like, we were trying to, like, we were trying to make a video that was, like, against, like date rape and abuse and all this shit. And it was so difficult because we were, like, trying to make this statement, but it was like so hard because, like, and the video didn't really, it doesn't really come across like that, like, and it's like
the things back from MTV and Legal were so great. They would just be like at 1:22.
I feel bad for the director and the guys who did that because they tried so hard and we didn't know what the fuck was going on. We were these kids, you know.
Yeah.
And like, you guys all of you and them having to do the edit and them doing the for whatever budget
edits
they had, you know, like, I'm sure the budget was, you know, was like whatever, and it was, oh my
five
god,
grand or
yeah like oh my god, even $5,000 for a video. You think about that now. The video I just did for Vera Lynn, I, like, you know, yeah, just thinking about that, like, I was thinking about $5,000 for a video, like, shit, if we had
$10,000.
Yeah. Oh my
god. And then also the difference between medicine and the dose. I remember I had to change, they wrote back with comments saying, when they're taking out the hoses, is there a way, like, there were some
parts
of it
was too gross.
It was too gross. I was like, really?
Yeah, oh my god. And I remember, okay, so on the difference between medicine and poison video, a little backstage, a little bloop of that video. I'm on like muscle relaxers the entire. I'm so fucked up. I'm on all these pills on that thing, and I'm like so out of my mind. I had no idea, and I thought the pills were gonna help me go wild in the video. I was like, I had muscle relaxers. I had something else. I had like something else, but I took like all these downers. And I was like such a dummy about it. And it was reacting in a shitty way. And I think I was drinking red wine and Coca-Cola mixed together with Jesse Camp, who was like
Jesse Camp. He was a PA there?
Yeah. And
the Jesse
I couldn't
Camp.
Know. Dude, I was so. And the guy, Travis, the guy who directed that video, was so great. He was so fun. But I was like out of my mind. And I didn't know how to act. I was like, I'm in front of a camera. I don't know what I'm supposed to do. There's no audience here. I'm not good with that stuff. I'm not good with it. Just like I can do certain things really good, but I thought like I could do good in the video. And when I see the video now, I'm like, I look so stupid. The video looks great, but I hate like the performance stuff in the videos are like so difficult for me. That's why I try to make jokes out of it all the time.
Now you've mentioned that, you know, that you're going through that stuff and you've obviously done a bunch of articles about that. And what do you notice now when it's a bad situation? What do you do differently? Like because someone listening might be like, I'm in those situations. I'm in this super hot band. We're doing Warped Tour. We're headlining. All these things are coming at me. Like, how do you now understand it and do a different way?
I don't know if somebody went back to young me and said, you have to try meditation and you have to deal with this thing and you have to go back. Like, a lot of it, you know, I wasn't able to really look at myself back then and deal with some of the insecurity issues that I had, talk about feeling insecure. It was something I was trying to like mask, you know, as like a confidence. And I think that's an incredible burden for people to carry, like trying to think that you're something that you're not. And for me, laying that all out on the line and kind of just emptying myself in that way has made it less difficult to go through the stressors in my life. Now when I'm going through things, I meditate a lot, meditate twice a day, and I find myself doing it in the midst of conversations. Like, there's ways to do it where you can still stay engaged and just breathing. I practice different types of exercise, yoga. I will sometimes do, you know, things like CrossFit or kickboxing, and I experiment with different things with my body and just feeling good. I try to eat healthy. I eat healthy, you know. I don't drink. I don't take any type of. I don't.
It's crazy what sleep,
drink.
Eating well, and doing that does.
I don't drink and smoke cigarettes. You know, I don't take like, you know, I don't do like hard drugs and any of that stuff. Like, you know, I keep my mind. I try to keep people around me that keep me balanced. You know, like I couldn't give somebody in my position that was like me when I was doing Warped Tour back in 2007 or whatever, I couldn't have given me advice because I was too much of a stubborn asshole, thought I knew everything, you know? So maybe if anything, if you're lost and you're in that situation that you described, maybe think about that you don't know everything and take a step back at what your certainties are of your situation. And maybe they aren't so uncertain. Maybe the burdens that you feel aren't something that you need to own on up to, and maybe letting go of those things is something that would benefit you.
I mean, what a crazy time too. I think to survive that. Yeah. If this scene was just the EVR, they did a few things, did a few tours, did the East Coast run, but it got this level, and to think all of your peers probably had some of the same issues, and to come out and still be around. I mean, talking to people in other bands, if it's Buddy or if it's the dude from Hawthorne Heights, or they're still doing it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a testament.
Two great examples of people who went through the wash, you know, and really came out on the other end and able to look at themselves and be like, hey, you know, like, I can't, you know, Buddy is such a, you know, he is an inspirational dude to me. And, I have had conversations just about getting clean and about, you know, just being honest about your feelings with the people who are supporting you and how that is such an enormous relief. I can't really speak. I met the dude from Hawthorne Heights a bunch, and he's a really, really nice dude, you know, but he has consistently been a supportive dude.
But you made it out,
Circa.
And I feel like that, to get out of still being able to do it and have a career from it is it kind of
a
rad thing.
People think, like, you know, you see a band like go through ebb and flow of things, and I think that a lot of bands get to a point where they think that, like, they always have to be here, and it's like sometimes the brushstroke of your career is going to be a lighter one than the next, you know, and it's important to put out records that you want, and if that means that that's going to, you're going to take a dip or you're going to have to play smaller venues or whatever, if you're going to take that into a personal way, it's going to destroy you creatively. That you have to look at what you're doing and with full gratitude. Like, if you are concentrating on gratitude, and it sounds silly, you know, but you can never have enough of it, you know. And if you're looking to be popular and famous and really big all the time, you're always going to be disappointed, because that shit is going to happen and it won't last. It'll come and go. It's like a thing. You just have to enjoy, you know, for me,
creating.
I enjoy creating. I enjoy making it and performing it. And of course, there's moments where you're on top of the mountain where you're like, holy shit, this view is beautiful, you know? But there's also when you're looking up at it and it's beautiful still, you know? And knowing that you're not being attached to it in a way where it needs to serve you, where you look at it as your master and you're just serving it.
And there's, it's that never ending mountain kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like,
You never arrive anywhere. You're always, you're in a constant, perpetual state of becoming.
With the new record that you're doing, the solo record, mm-hmm. you know, would you still be in love?
Yeah.
Like, what was that level, or what was that next for you?
That whole concept, like, would you still be in love if, after 10 years, would you still be in love, like, after you saw the dark side of somebody, after you, throw up after getting super drunk and have to get your hair hauled back, or you say the thing you didn't mean, or you forgot the thing that you needed to remember, you know, after 15 years of being a band, after, you know, 10 years of being a partner, after 10 years of being a wife, things like that. You know, that is something that I was just been reflecting on a lot because of these 10-year tours. And so would you still be in love just came up out of that, you know, came out of all of these relationships that, like, you lose over time. You know, I've lost people. There's new people. There's, you know, and you can get obsessed and attached mm-hmm. with how that makes you feel in one way or the other, but if you just center yourself on gratitude and just being happy for what you had and wishing the best for people, you know, then I'm going to be okay. That's my goal. That's like my mantra from it. But and that would you still be in love is just sort of a like the chanting of that mantra.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's rad, man. Is there anything else you want to do? Anything you haven't done?
Yeah, I mean,
dreams.
Sometimes I think about doing voiceover stuff, and I would love to do that because I think that would be fun.
I've
tried to do it. I've like did some stuff with a guy who did Matt Stosky, the director of a bunch of Dying to Reach You video and illustration video for Circa. He did a cool thing that I did some stuff for, but I always thought that would be cool. I always like wanted to be like the like bartender who like had no lines but was just like wiping a glass like in the behind the scenes like in a cool movie, like, you know, like I always wanted to do cool creative, like being a part of creative stuff like that. But really what I love doing is writing poetry and singing, and that's what I get to do. That's all my life is centered around that, you know, like it's how my family is sustained. It's how I am sustained.
How amazing is that?
Creatively and financially. It's
Colin was mentioning that.
It's unreal.
He was like, we have a career. We just played Terminal. The Terminal 5 show, we hung out. I was like, we just played Terminal 5. I get to do this. And I go home and then we go. It's almost like you've got this cycle and movement and people are going to show up. Like last night at Le Poisson Rouge, like just packed.
I was surprised the show was sold out last night, just because we've done lots of shows in New York City, and New York's always really, really fun. It's always, I remember playing a circus show at the Knitting Factory, and I always remember this snapshot of the room because it seemed like the whole room was like an actual wave, like a fluid wave, like just like people just going out of their minds in unison. But last night was something really special. you know, being up there with my buddies, some of them I've known since high school, and playing some of those songs that have been a part
of Avalon my life. Was 10 years. When I got the email, mm-hmm. I was like, that's not 10. It is.
Yes. It doesn't feel like it. I mean, that's something that old people say, but it doesn't feel like it to me.
We're old. It's okay. You can forget.
I like it. I mean, I don't like when people, like, I've been asked the question, like, do you feel old? And I'm like, yeah, but I like it. Like, I don't feel like limited by it. Like, I don't feel like some old crotchety man. Like, I have more energy now than I ever did because I was getting fucked up when I was in my 20s, you know? And I, you know, now that you're not getting fucked up all the time, you get people take you slightly more seriously. And I'm able to do more things now and that make me happy. And, you know, like, I feel I'm really proud of being father. You know, I'm really proud of, like, my boys. I feel like if I was to get hit by a bus tomorrow, my boys would 100% be all able to say that they, like, had so much love and attention from their dad. You know, and that is, like, my end goal. Like, all this stuff is fun and it's great and this is my day to do stuff. But, like, I feel like that is, like, my ultimate, my paramount. You know, and I know that without a doubt. Like, I'm able to confidently say that I, like, am engaged and present for them, and that's, like, that's everything to me, you know. So it's like gratitude is a huge part of what keeps me going through all this shit. It's weird to say that. I say that, but I'm also, like, 2.5 hours away from them, and I can't see them tonight because
you have to go to Boston. That sucks.
It's a weird thing because I like, talking about being present for them, giving them attention. Like, I have, like, literally just today, like, going through this, like, whole set of emotions of, like, not, like, saying goodbye to them and having to go through this. Oh. Every tour, it's, like, this thing, you know? But I've, like, embraced it as part of a thing that, like,
that's cool.
Eventually the pain of longing wears down into, like, you're grateful for it, and you're like, man, longing is a beautiful agony.
Yeah. Did you have fun?
I did.
I'm so glad we got to do this.
This was this was great. I'm not great at this stuff, and I
hope you're comfortable with me. We've known each other for long.
I am so comfortable with you. I just did one of these with the guy from Silverstein, Shane, and it was really cool. And it was on the phone, and it was really he's great. I drank a espresso right before I did it, and so I was like, yeah, even more than I was today. But I really like this. I love talking to you, and we hardly ever get a chance to talk.
That's
about
what I know. It was like an excuse. Can we just can we schedule an hour? Next time you're back in town,
let's do one where we just go. Let's schedule a whole just dinner where we can just sit down
and we can do it outside. We could just have a couple mics set up.
Yeah,
done.
I love this.
Okay, cool. I'm so glad you got to
listen to podcasts. I don't listen to podcasts.
I don't listen to podcasts either. I'll be
that's
honest.
Crazy. You're a podcast guy.
It's just 7 years I don't listen to them.
I listen to, like, once in a while, Colin will send me something about, like, mushrooms or something weird or, like, Bitcoin. I'll be like, this is cool. But, like, I don't really listen to I listen to music. Like,
well, I just want to say I love that we've gotten to stay in touch.
Yeah, me too.
I'm editing all this out.
You're all good.
We got in touch that we're able to.
You should do
like
one cut.
I want to help you.
You should do this special one cut where you just don't edit anything. You just go.
Oh my god!
You're gonna have to because I went on like 15-minute rants.
The other funny thing about you being in Atlantic, and we have to leave. You have to leave in 2 minutes,
dude. It's not this building just intimidates me. You know, if anything, I don't have any beef with Atlantic at all. If anything, it's just that, like, I couldn't keep up with them. I felt like I was a kid. I wanted to do right by them. I wanted to do right by my band.
It'd be different.
Probably. Everything I do now is different because of,
that's
like, you know,
mean.
Just because of my, like, my mind frame. I feel like I didn't do them justice, you know, like, I you know,
there
was Anthony Delia. What a great dude.
I have his extension.
What a great dude. What a great dude. I mean, a bunch of guys. And Craig Calvin was a great dude who believed in the band. You know, all those people were, and Julie and Liv. All those people were great, and they really believed in the band. I just, you know, and I look back on all of that as very important brushstrokes on tapestry
learning.
Of our career.
Yeah, that was
but
crazy.
It's intimidating being in this building. And I always will be intimidated by it because I come in here and I'm like, can you make me make music forever? That's it. It's a tidal wave of that.